Morning, Senator Sinjam. I'd like to call to order this meeting of the Tax Reform Division of the Senate Committee on Taxes. We will wait to deal with the amendments, with the minutes. We'll wait to deal with amendments, minutes, excuse me again, later. Today we have two basic subject matters that we're going to be discussing. One of them is the research and development credit, making some changes in that. We've been dealing with this issue for any number of years, and we're going to take another run at it this morning. We'll proceed in the same way that we did before or the other day when we had bills that dealt with the same area. That is, we'll present the bills. If there are any amendments to be put on, we'll do that. And then we'll take testimony, all the testimony at one time regarding the anybody that wants to speak about the R&D credit. And then we have two bills dealing with essentially dealing with vendor allowances in the sales tax area, and also some other changes in responsibilities for reporting sales tax and remitting sales tax. So, Senator Sinjam, why don't you present 351 now, and then I'll do 38. I do have an amendment on mine, and then so you present yours, and then I'll come and present my two, and then we'll have the testimony on both of them. Is that agreeable? So Senator Sinjam brings us Senate File 351. Welcome again to the division. Senator Sinjam.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I do appreciate the opportunity to have this bill before you this morning. I think it's an important bill, as all bills are, frankly. We know that. Senate File 351 seeks to amend a Minnesota statute dealing with the credit for increasing research activities. That's the title of the statute within our state framework. Certainly is an important area. As you know, we are an innovation and technology state, and the bill specifically seeks to extend the research credit opportunity to sole proprietors. And that is in addition to already on the books. That opportunity is available to those involved in corporate franchise taxes or individual income tax, pass-through entities, S-corps, LLCs, and so on and so forth. I think we all understand that one of the great strengths of Minnesota, certainly is research and innovation. In 2013, there were literally almost 4,300 patents coming out of our state. According to my little research, about number six per capita in our country. That's impressive, I think. In addition to that, given another bill I've authored this year on the medical device tax, I've come to find out that literally about 25% of that tax that is accumulated nationwide comes from Minnesota. So we are a huge medical device state, and we are by virtue of the fact that we have a great deal of infrastructure in terms of the education and the collaborative infrastructure, whether it's Life Science Alley or the Medical High Tech Association, and so on and so forth. But again, this is to extend the same research tax credit to sole proprietors. They are, in essence, maybe a small entity in terms of the overall group of people that are pursuing these kind of credits, but they're an important part. They're the innovators, they're the entrepreneurs that are kind of moving into this system and hopefully finding greatness at some point in their efforts. They also are the people that, frankly, may be attracted to other states that compete with us for these kind of innovative people. And so I hope that we can have a good hearing this morning. I know that we will, and discuss this. I would say you're probably going to hear some reservations from the Department of Revenue relative to cautionary comments about possible fraud and abuse. I think that's fair, certainly, but hopefully also fair, I think, is the opportunity that we might have to work on our language to fix those edges, as they might be called, and make this a good pursuit. So, Madam Chair, if you would, I'm finished with my testimony,
okay,
and
right
if you
there.
Want to offer yours, why, we'll proceed.
Senator Deasy.
Madam Chair, I do appreciate the attention that Senator Senjum is giving to this issue, and it's been around for over 30 years. We initially passed the R&D credit. Actually, it's been around even longer than I have. Actually,
how about that?
since 1982, and in the beginning, it was given both to individuals and corporations, and then later on, it was limited to corporations, and then in 2010, because or at least in, as an explanation, to recognize. The tremendous advancement, if you will, of the way in which businesses organize themselves through S-corps and partnerships for those particular reasons and LLCs, it was extended to the members of those business structures. It still did not apply to individuals as sole proprietors. And so what Senate File 351 and also my bill, Senate File 38, does attempt to recapture that availability for individuals, sole proprietors, the people who file a Schedule C rather than reporting their income on a through a partnership or something else on a Schedule E, other kinds of income to take advantage of it. But as Senator Senjum just pointed out, the department and others have been concerned that we would be granting this credit not for proprietors, sole proprietors, individual entrepreneurs, creative folks who were actually investing in research and development, but people who were coming up with a new fishing lure and wanted their hobby supported by a tax credit. And so we have resisted that, but then it was suggested, well, maybe... and that what's in my bill, I think it answering some of this concerns that Senator Senjum expressed, that maybe there is a way that that could satisfy the concern about creating scoff laws under the research and development credit. And so what my bill does, and I'll need to make an amendment to make sure that that happens, which I'll do in just a second, is to have an application process only for the bill doesn't read that way, but it would be limited for an application process through deed for sole proprietors. And if the eligibility for the credit were made, you know, a legitimate ongoing business that is engaged truly in something other than a hobby, that if an application was made and approved, that information would be sent to the Department of Revenue and the credit could be granted. Because the credit would, the application would be made in the year prior, that would necessitate those who want the credit after it had been okayed to file an amended return in the year in which they apply for it. So if they had done the research or and made the application for 2014, got the credit, the application forwarded to the department in 2015, they could amend their 2014 return. Now, that's not the effective dates here, but that's the actual effect of the bill. So in order to make sure that that application process applies only to the individuals, Madam Chair, I'd like to offer the author's amendment, the A1 amendment.
Senator Russ moves to amend Senate File 38 with an A1 amendment. Any questions? All in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed? The amendment passes.
So, Madam Chair, if you look at the, I thought I had it right here. The actual cost of it for both the Sengen bill and the rest bill are very similar, $2.3 million. So it is in the first year. It is, I think, a reasonable start to recognizing the the ability of a single individual, not organized as a corporation or any of the other business structures, to engage in legitimate research and development and to benefit in Minnesota from that credit. Another concern has been raised, for which I do not have an amendment, and I will pursue that as well. But just in talking with some folks about it, that this is supposed to be a research and development credit that is based on the activity of the sole proprietorship under this single individual and not an attempt to reduce the tax liability of income earned by, for example, a spouse. So it is not an attempt to so that you couldn't say, well, I'm going to do this, and then I'm just going to wipe out my spouse's income tax liability. I'm not quite sure how to meet that concern, but I think it is a legitimate one because, obviously, if you give it to, you know, the research credit to a corporation, they can't use it to reduce the income liabilities of their directly of their employees, of their spouses. So that would be a parallel that we'll be looking at there. But I do think that this can return us to a sole proprietorship credit and is a way that we do not overburden the Department of Revenue in particular with what I would call nuisance audit responsibility. I did speak yesterday with to let her know that this bill was coming forward and asking her to ask her staff to review it with the Commissioner of Deed. And I haven't gotten any response yet from them, but we have a lot of time to deal with this issue, and I hope that we can be successful in dealing with it. Another, with that, Madam Chair, if you would lay over.
Madam Chair.
We have some testimony.
Unless you have a question.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Senator Zelka. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Russ, I just have a question to help me understand it. My guess is this is mostly startups. If they're sole proprietors, that's the phase that they're in. You know, typically, if you're farther into a business career, you're going to form a partnership, a S corp, C corp, whatever. But is that, first of all, is that true? And then secondly, so then your goal is to really help the startups and keep them in Minnesota? Is that the idea?
I would say yes, and of course the language of the bill strikes out the partnerships and that kind of thing, but then by putting in individuals, although we might be talking mostly about the sole proprietors, it also still includes individuals that you know get some sort of K-1 you know report of income that they report elsewhere. So, Madam Chair, I would request that you lay over, move that it be laid over for.
We have some testifiers, I believe. First,
Madam Chair, we're going to wait after the presentation for my next bill, and then we'll have the testifying on the research and development credit.
I have one quick question. When you're discussing on reducing the spouse's income, I understand that people could easily use that to manipulate the system, but if a lot of these are startups, aren't a lot of the spouse's income probably also, are you going to look at if the spouse's income are also using to help subsidize and move this product forward?
Madam Chair, I don't know yet what... how you could distinguish between the income earned by the spouse in support of the research and development that's going on as opposed to having nothing to do with it and they are off teaching all day long or something. But it was an issue raised, and I think we need to address it in some way, and maybe that's a minor concern will not be an issue, but I think we need to have all the issues on the table, even if we don't have all the answers yet.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, so with that, we are going to lay over Senate File 351 and Senate File 38.
As amended.
Is that a motion?
Yep. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes.
Okay. Then the next bill is a bill to once again try and make the research and development credit more, frankly, more generous. And Senator I don't have the agenda in front of me. Do we have more than one bill on this?
No, we just have your Senate file 305. The next one is Conan's, I believe.
Okay. I think it's Senator Conan's bill, that is.
Madam Chair, I'll be presenting.
Why am I seeing something different here? I want to talk about the refundability of the credit. So
yes, that's 305.
That is Senate File 305.
Yes. Okay. Yep, that's what we're going to talk about.
And we've gone back and forth with this in Minnesota tax policy as well, and I don't know that it's what the back and forth, that the back and forth represents a difference in a policy perspective as opposed to do we have the wherewithal to make it refundable, and we have gone back and forth. Currently, it is a non-refundable credit, which we understand means that you're able to reduce your tax liability to zero, but not beyond that. Although there is a carry forward period to be able to use the credit for a period of 15 years, and I think that is in law in order to recognize the nature of startup companies or where the investment is being made, and that it could be used later as the company starts earning income. that would be taxable. We know from hearing a lot of testimony, however, that sometimes these the new startup companies are can be, depending on where they are, what industry sector they're working in, could be as long as 7 or 8 years before they turn it around and receive some benefit from their research that they have done. So it's in there for 15 years, and I think we should keep that. However, I also think that it's an important enough incentive, reward, however you want to characterize it, that we go back to making it more, refundable. And under the bill that I have before you, we would change it from being a non-refundable credit to a refundable credit with a limit on it, of the refundable portion of that being limited to $200,000, which is an investment of $2 million since the credit percentage is 10%. And then secondly, since there's two tiers of eligible expenses, that any expenses in excess of that first tier where you would get a refundable credit, that would increase from 2.5% to 4%, and that part of it would be non-refundable and again eligible for a 15-year carry forward. Obviously, these numbers are scalable. You could put the percentage that would be refundable lower or higher. You could put the percentage of expenses eligible for the non-refundable credit higher as well. But what we're looking at in here, and I would draw your attention to the revenue estimate, is the particular points that I have just brought up. It's not cheap to do this, but we need to understand how much tax relief and investment we would be making in Minnesota businesses by doing this. So, Madam Chair, with that, Senator Sinjim and I would be happy to welcome people who want to testify on any of these three bills. Right?
Yep.
All right, thank you. First, we have Mark Gross, CEO Formacote, and also Scott Schmidt, Principal Blackline Group, if they would like to both come forward. And please welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Yes,
thank you.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Mark Gross, and I am owner, sole proprietor of Formacote LLC.
Do you want to testify or say anything?
Oh, yes. I wasn't sure if you were ready for that or not yet. Mm-hmm. Right. So, Formacote is a medical device company. We coat medical devices for other medical device companies, make them slippery so they go up and down your veins and arteries nicely. And it is 14 years old. And I know we've been talking a little bit about, you know, how long is a startup. And I can tell you the last few years, through a variety of issues, I've been unprofitable. And being an LLC, according to my CPA, has allowed me the ability to stay viable as a company because of the tax tax loss rollover into my family's finances. And I know Scott has some additional perspective on that, but in those years where I was losing money and sustaining the company and my employees, I have 14 employees, through putting money back in to the business, I was able to reduce my tax liability at the time. But this whole time, I'm missing out on the R&D tax credits. And I'm a real company. You know, I have 14 employees, and they're doing the work. And yet, because I'm a sole proprietor, because I've taken the risk to do this on myself, we're not getting the credit. That's why we're this disregarded entity element. And there has been questions of why am I not a C corp or an S corp, and I've had to dig into those. And my understanding from my CPA is that if I was a very successful and profitable business, I would be a C corp or an S corp, and I don't know which. But because I've had this rocky road, it's more effective and efficient, and basically has allowed my company and my family to stay alive during these rocky years, because I'm not an employee of my company, and I don't have then a regular paycheck that then has taxes deducted from it. And that's why I'm still an LLC. If I have 5 years of profitability and growing revenues, my CPA says, then you probably would switch. But being an LLC and a sole proprietor is a terrible reason to not get the R&D tax credit, because we really do research and development. It has kept us alive. It has kept us growing. And it's painful. This year I will be paying for 2014 income taxes, and basically it's sort of a myopic view of it, but that means that my income taxes would be going to other C Corp and S Corps for their research and development credits, but I don't get any, and it's inequitable.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Schmidt, state your name for the record.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. My name's Scott Schmidt, and I am an owner in a couple businesses that have interest in the R&D tax credit. One of them is a software development company, which obviously involves a lot of R&D, but where I spend the majority of my time and why I'm here today is I own a business that is a consulting company that helps companies across the country take advantage of the R&D tax credit. So we're practitioners. So we're not an accounting firm. We don't do any other tax work. All we do is focus on the R&D tax credit. And so I have kind of a national perspective on, you know, state credits across the country, as well as what's going on within companies. So I appreciate that we're discussing this today. From a practitioner standpoint, I struggle to understand why sole proprietors do not qualify for the R&D tax credit, because I talk with hundreds of companies a year, and if I didn't know how they were structured, if they were C Corp, S Corp, LLP, partnership, if I looked at the activity, you know, you look at the activities, and they're all doing activities that qualify. But for some reason, there's a very small subset of companies that are sole proprietors here in Minnesota that don't qualify, even though inside the building they're doing the exact same types of activities. And it's my belief, one point is that sole proprietors are doing R&D as defined by the code, without a doubt, Mark being a great example. Number two, my belief is that the hit to the state's budget would be very small. We've been in business for 13 years, and I can tell you we have – when you look at all the clients we've worked with, it's been less than a handful that are sole proprietors. We see very, very, very few sole proprietors that where it makes sense to pursue the R&D tax credit. Because number one, first of all, in order to pursue the credit, you have to be doing the activities that qualify. And then number two, it needs to make sense to pursue. There needs to be an ROI. It needs to be worth the time to go after. It needs to make sense to hire somebody to, you know, a consultant to maybe help you, and or even if your CPA is going to help you, they're going to charge you something. So there needs to be an economic benefit. And when you get to a company like Mark's size, 10, 14 people, whatever it is, you're going to have plenty of qualified expenditures that can make it worthwhile to pursue. But a lot of sole proprietors are like one- and two-person shops, and there's going to be no benefit, or there's not going to be much benefit to pursue. And so if you take all those, you know, onesies and twos, you know, one- and two-person shops that are sole proprietors, and if they all were to pursue the R&D tax credit for some reason, I still I think the number would be very small. So my point is in the big picture, I think the impact to the state budget is small, because for a lot of the one- and two-person shops, it just won't make sense. What you have out there is you have a lot of sole proprietors, the one- and two-person shops, where they're getting together at night after their day jobs and in their garages on the weekends. And if they're not paying themselves a wage, they're not generating an R&D tax credit. They can be coming up with the most innovative ideas and unbelievable things that have ever been seen. But if they're not paying themselves a wage, there's no credit to be had.
Thank you. I'll make a note of that when you mentioned the R&D in the garage. Medtronics was formed started in a garage in my district. So
I
remind people that all the time. You mentioned that you did some work across the country, and I hate to ask a question that I don't know the answer for, but does California and some of the other states allow R&D research credits for sole proprietorships?
Mm-hmm.
They do. Okay. Mm-hmm. Any questions, members? Okay. Thank you for your testimony.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
The first witness, I think, pointed out something very important, that for individuals now, they have to be members of a partnership or S-corps. That's what it's limited to. And under both Senator Simpson's bill and my bill, it would extend to every individual, regardless of the way in which their business is organized. And I really like it that your CPA has told you that it's more than just the tax impacts that should, in fact, it shouldn't probably be that at all in some sense, that that should determine what is the best kind of organization for your business activity to have. We would much prefer people to make decisions about how they're organized based on factors, type of business, qualified workforce, this and that and the other thing, of how their business is organized, rather than just what their tax liabilities are going to be. Sometimes we hear too much about that, but I thank you for pointing that out. So it's individuals, regardless of or irrespective of their business organization, the way in which they are structured under the law, that would be eligible for this. And indeed, as the second testifier pointed out, it is in the larger scheme of things, it is a very it's not a minimal impact, but it is it certainly is not something that will break the bank. And at $2.3 million a year, and then maybe increasing over time. And I would just point out on the second page of the revenue estimate that there are a lot of things about this that aren't known because we would be changing it. But they use the data collected from sole proprietors from tax year 2013 returns. And they assume in the estimate that the R&D credit for individual taxpayers would increase by 15% and that the total amount would increase by 6%. And, you know, we don't know how they come up with those numbers, but those are the ones we accept, and we accept their researchers' evaluations and estimates. But I do think it's time that we return to allowing individuals to do it, and that we do it judiciously and cautiously, and perhaps Mr. Gross can take advantage of it before he becomes profitable. Even.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Particularly if it's going to be if we can also move forward on refundability. So thank you very much, gentlemen.
Senator Gazelka.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Rest, I'm thinking if the dollar numbers are actually higher than the fiscal note projected,
doesn't matter.
Right. It could very well mean that we're helping more startups become successful and we're all winning.
Mr. Schmidt.
Madam Chair, quick question. Is this where we also testify about the refundability aspect, or do we wait on that?
You can do it now.
Okay, so I've already explained how we work with companies all across the country, take advantage of the R&D tax credit. We work, we help companies with both the federal and their state credits. And as you know, Minnesota was was the innovator, the first state to implement a state R&D tax credit, which put us out there in the lead. And then over time, many states began to implement R&D tax credits, and as that time went on, the Minnesota credit was average at best. And then in 2010, as you know, the state took some big steps to enhance the Minnesota state R&D tax credit, increased the value, made it available to more people, and made it refundable. And when they added those features to the Minnesota credit, the Minnesota credit rocketed up to the top, you know, right up near the top of the list as far as the best state credits in the country. Since then, as you know, the refundability feature has been taken away, and the Minnesota credit on that chart of how, you know, where credits are, when you look at all the different features, not just the value, but who can take advantage, it again fell back into the pack and became a very average credit. There's states, for instance, California, not only is it value-wise is very good. In fact, a lot of times it can be it's equal to a company's federal credit, sometimes a little more. In California, you can apply the California state credit against the alternative minimum tax. In Pennsylvania, they have two-tier program. A certain credit amount if your assets are over $5 million, if your assets are under $5 million. For smaller companies, it's a bigger credit. And in Pennsylvania, if you can generate a credit but you can't use it, you can monetize it by selling it. So it's, you know, where refundability is one way to get cash back in the pockets of a business or owner, in Pennsylvania, you can monetize it by selling it, which is another way to get that cash back into the pockets of an owner. And as I said, in California, you can apply it against AMT, the alternative minimum tax. It's another way to get cash back into the pockets of the owner. So, and I'll tell you, yesterday, my last meeting of the day, I met with a owner of a small software development company, four people, and they're struggling to keep the lights on. And they were referred to me by a veteran software individual from the software industry who had experience with the Minnesota credit in the past and being refundable, and suggested that the owner get together with me just to see if there was some benefit to being able to take advantage of the refundability aspect in prior years of the Minnesota credit, because you can go, if you've not taken advantage of the credit, you can go back to prior years and amend your tax returns. So unfortunately, as it turns out for this business owner, in 2011 and 2012, when the credit was refundable, they didn't have enough expenditures to make it worth their while. But in 13 and 14, they began to ramp up, and now they're at a point where they have enough qualified wages where it would make sense to pursue a Minnesota credit, and they can, but it's not refundable. So that level of QREs, or qualified expenditures, they have right now would generate them $15,000 to $20,000 Minnesota credit. It's not pocket change. You know, when you're trying to, you know, pay the bills, that amount of money helps. And if you haven't been watching the news, healthcare costs have been going up, and hiring's getting tougher. If you're familiar with manufacturing, there's not nearly enough employees out there for manufacturers to hire. And so finding good people to hire is requiring good benefits, of which healthcare has gone up, and it requires good salaries. Again, if you saw the headlines, people are starting to job hop again because, you know, the economy's improving. People are moving around, and you got to be competitive. And that extra cash from a refundable Minnesota credit can help go offset those increased medical costs and those increased wages that people have to pay to draw top talent to make their company successful. So I would urge you and the committee and the state of Minnesota to think about how to, you know, how we get Minnesota back up at the top of the chart as far as a place to do business. So thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mandel.
Good morning. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Shay Mandel. I'm the president and CEO of Life Science Alley, and it's always a pleasure to come down and talk about our industry and in particular the exceptional work that goes on here in Minnesota. As you all know, Life Science Alley is the largest state-based life science organization in the country, directly reflective of the community that we have here. We have more than 600 members in Minnesota, from Mayo to the University of Minnesota to 3M, Medtronic, St. Jude Medical. And, you know, we're really here to work with you to make sure that our environment here in Minnesota is the best in the world. We've provided you with a handout, and I'll hit a couple of the numbers, but what I really want to do is bring a bit more color to sort of today's story of where we are. In terms of economic impact, you know, I think the data is compelling. 50% of Minnesota's jobs are based on intellectual property created through R&D in our state. We've got, you know, more than 170,000 people working just in the life science industries here in the state, more than $5 billion invested in R&D, and perhaps most importantly, the jobs that everybody wants, an annual wage that exceeds $95,000 a year for our life science companies. No surprise, Minnesota's always been a leader in terms of policy, and no surprise, other states like to steal our ideas. I just came back from some meetings in New Orleans with my peers, and New York and Colorado and other states are looking specifically at creating refundability as a way to move their states forward. And they're modeling that legislation specifically on our old refundability statute. So it was a great idea and something we definitely want to see happen again. On the story side, you know, this year in July, the Smithsonian is setting up a 10-year exhibit called Places of Innovation, and there are a handful of places of innovation that the Smithsonian is recognizing. One of them is Silicon Valley. More importantly, one of them is Medical Alley. The difference between our creation in the 50s in your district, Senator, is that today the garages in Northeast, in Worthington, in Rochester, in Duluth, are led by entrepreneurs who are already talking to investors in San Francisco, manufacturers in Texas, distributors in China, and setting up clinical trials in Eastern Europe. The world is different today, and capital and knowledge moves freely. Policies like these, policies that make Minnesota competitive to the bean counters who don't understand our culture, to the investors in California who aren't thinking about our ecosystem, allows them to check the boxes, move forward, and continue to see expansion, growth, and investment in our state. And, you know, most of the money that does get invested ultimately does come from outside of our state and outside of the Midwest. So, you know, as we see New York and Colorado, California and Massachusetts with their 15% R&D tax credits, you know, I urge the committee, again, to continue your support for this industry. It drives Minnesota's economy. We're more dependent on it than anyone else. And as the world continues to get smaller and our people continue to get smarter and more connected, keeping this industry in Minnesota will be as much a product of the policy decisions we make as it will be the innovations that have driven our economy. So, again, thank you for your support. We look forward to working with you to keep our economy strong and pass this bill. And I'm happy to answer any questions.
Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mandel, the second to the last bullet said one of the world's largest medical device companies started in Minnesota, plans to invest $10 billion over 10 years in promising new medical health coverages. Minnesota could benefit from these investments given the state's strength in these industries. You know, there was news in the last year about an expansion, not necessarily in Minnesota. If we were to go about changing this, would that change that picture?
Mr. Mandel.
Would it change Medtronic's current plans?
Yeah.
I'll say yes and no. So here's the important part. As Minnesotans, I mean, everybody has a strong opinion on the business decisions that Medtronic has made. So let's get it out there. I mean, you know, we're talking about Medtronic. This isn't a problem Minnesota can solve. It's certainly a problem that we'd love to see Congress solve. But the reality is that Medtronic's choice is great for the United States, and it's particularly great for Minnesota, because now Medtronic gets to do what an innovative company like Medtronic wants to do, which is invest a lot of money in the most innovative technologies. And the reality is that 97% of the investments that companies in healthcare want to make are in the United States. And there's only a couple places in this country where people look to make those investments. It's Boston, it's California, it's here. So, you know, as Medtronic frees up capital to invest, they're going to be looking at those places. Where they invest, and where Boston invests, and St. Jude, and where Coloplast invests, and many of our members that are both, you know, domestic and foreign corporations, has a, you know, part of that big analysis is, you know, what's the return, what's the tax policies going to look like? So, you know, Medtronic's, again, decision, I think, is going to be great for our community. But ultimately, how much gets invested here versus, say, Boston or Austin or San Francisco, policies like this will have an impact on those decisions. And again, the more competitive we can be, then I think the more likely we are to get that investment. And I would add one thing, Senator, that I didn't say. We have some inherent advantages. This is truly a community unlike any other. This is a better business environment in many ways than who we compete against, Boston, the Bay Area. But states like Arizona are putting, you know, 24% tax credits on the first $2.5 million, and then 20%. So again, as capital moves and brains move, and all of a sudden, you know, Mayo has operations in Arizona, there are states who want what we have. And so, you know, our ability to continue to be competitive, I think, then leverages our inherent advantages. And I think, you know, we expect to see a lot of Medtronic's growth occurring here in Minnesota.
Madam Chair, and just a final comment. Just that you are playing with us. I appreciate the last couple of years, there were no threats. There were just realities. Mm-hmm. And that you continue to be, you know, very clear about how we can help you and what hurts. At the end of the day, all the components that make Minnesota great is what we want to put together so that companies like Medtronic and Boston and others are here, grow here, and stay here. So I just want to make sure that you continue to be crystal clear about what we can do to make it better.
Absolutely. And startups have been mentioned, of course. And, you know, one of the things you'll see in the Smithsonian exhibit is that, you know, today we have, you know, more than 400 early-stage medical technology companies, to say nothing of the biotech companies, the pharmaceutical companies, quite a vibrant life science industry here in Minnesota. And, you know, those companies ultimately stem from, you know, that first creation. St. Jude Medical was started by someone who left Medtronic, Manny Villafana. You know, every little company we work with today, everybody traces back to St. Jude or Medtronic. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the combination of keeping our large companies strong and growing and keeping those people here also helps us to, you know, move on to the smaller companies, and those people are more investable, right? So, you know, they've got experience. They are the people who can pull dollars from outside the state and can keep their companies here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really do respect Medtronic and have appreciated the work in my community and the state. I just have a little trouble with providing more tax breaks for a corporation that's doing a tax inversion, costing the United States up to $19 billion over 10 years in federal tax. To me, that just rubs me wrong. And I continue to support different things that we can do to help the company, but I just think there's probably other areas that need the tax benefit more than at this time after the tax inversion than Medtronic does.
Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I point out to Senator Eaton that businesses are in business to make a profit. And if the federal government doesn't like the ability to engage in certain kinds of behaviors to avoid federal income tax, they can certainly change the law. But Medtronic, every other company, has a responsibility to its owners, to its stockholders, to its employees to make a profit. And one of the ways you make more profit is to minimize your tax burden. So I had to go on record and point out there is no evil. There is no wrong in minimizing tax burden. And the fact that Medtronic is doing that is rational. They should do it. Any reasonable professionals would advise them to do it, and it's the best thing for the people that own the company. And I would point out it is also the best thing for consumers of goods that Medtronic produces because they can put more money into R&D and production rather than giving it to the taxing authority.
Okay, Senator Eaton, for a follow-up, and then we'll move on.
I just need to state that one of the important things about the corporations in the United States is that they need to reinvest in this country. And taking advantage of loopholes to make a profit, to take funds from the country, which provide the backbone and the base from which their companies were able to grow, is not necessarily a good thing.
Mr. Mandel.
Avoiding all the politics of this, of course, I'd just like to make a couple of comments. I mean, the R&D tax credit is about specific investment in high-wage jobs in our state. We get very excited when companies like Olympus, that is not a U.S.-based company, expands here. We get very excited when a company like Coloplast takes over, you know, an old brownfield, you know, down on the river and, you know, redoes its headquarters for the U.S. here. We get very excited when companies, foreign or domestic, invest in our people, spend their money in our state. And that's what this is really about. So, you know, this is about how we continue to grow a place where high-wage jobs drive our economy, where the knowledge economy is based here. And again, regardless of whether that headquarters exists in California or Japan or Ireland, these are our people working in these jobs, and the R&D tax credit supports them and their families. And so, I would point out that I think we want as much investment from outside of Minnesota to be happening in Minnesota as possible, and this bill helps to stimulate that activity.
Thank you. Thank you, both of you. Next, we have Jill Larson and Beth Cadoon.
Madam Chair, can I make one point and then I'm out of here?
Sure.
I forgot to say our neighbors to the south have a refundable tax credit.
Thank you. Who would like to go first?
I'll go first.
Thank you. State your name for the record.
Morning, Madam
Welcome
Chair, members. My name is Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. I'll skip some of my comments because they've been said by previous witnesses, and I completely support what they've said. I think one thing I want to add to some of the comments that were made is that we really see the R&D credit and the increase and the reversion to refundability as an economic development tool for the state of Minnesota. There's a lot of bills being debated this session that are around the area of economic development, and I think our members see this as a very effective economic development tool that's been helpful in the past. But as was mentioned earlier, our R&D credit has been weakened in terms of other states have really beefed up their credits, and our credits become a little less competitive. And I think that if you look at it in terms of the investment that this bill would make, yes, there is a cost to the state general fund to it, but I think the ROI on it would more than pay for it because of the increased economic activity, the high-wage jobs, all the other spillover economic benefits that would come if we can get more R&D done in Minnesota. And I think we also have to think about retaining the jobs that we have here now. Even if we lost a very small percentage of the R&D activity that's currently being done here, even if we lost that activity to another state or another country, that would have a huge ripple effect, a negative ripple effect on the state's economy, and there would be a cost to that as well. So we would hope that you would look at this in terms of an investment, and we think the ROI on it is worth worth what's in the revenue note. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Cadoon. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Beth Cadoon. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I'm here to testify in support of the bills, and I thank Senators Senjum and Senator Rest for bringing these forward. One thing, it's all been very well stated, so I'll be very short. But as Minnesota has been very successful in the past, as you've heard, is our innovation. You mentioned Medtronic starting in a garage. That's true of all our Fortune 500 companies, is that they are all homegrown. And so the question is, for Minnesota to be successful in the future, is how do you encourage that innovation to continue? We think the R&D has been a very strategic tax tool that's been very helpful in continuing those good, strong-paying jobs in Minnesota and innovation. And so anything we can do to enhance it, we think would be, as Jill mentioned, a very good return on investment. We'd like to see a way to do the sole proprietor so we can help companies that came forward like Mark Gross's company, how we can continue those and encourage those sole proprietors to do innovation in the state as well. So anything we can do there, we think would be very helpful as well. With that, I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you. Any questions, member? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Carnival, if you can keep it
Madam Chair,
brief.
Very briefly, Doug Carnival, representing the Minnesota High Tech Association. Unfortunately, our leadership is out of town today, and I just want to associate myself with the remarks of my colleagues. We, too, very strongly support these bills and want to be on record as such. We've submitted a letter and some backup materials. We hope you have an opportunity to review those, and we'd be happy to provide any additional information that's necessary to show our support. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Rest.
I noticed that there are representatives from the department in the hearing, and I wonder if Mr. Cummings or someone he designates would like to share with us observations about this area that the department has made up to this point.
Thank you. Mr. Cummings, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest and members, for the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the tax policy manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Last night, I spoke to both Senator Senjum and Senator Rest about these provisions. I thank them for coming forward. Both conversations, I thought, were really sort of exciting. I mean, they were talking about ideas and how to make things work. So really, that was appreciative. So these bills related especially to sole proprietors. It would allow individuals, trusts, or estates who have businesses with qualified research expenses eligible for the R&D credit. I just wanted to talk about a couple of things that I heard today. We have been in contact and have heard and talked to Mr. Gross, and he is certainly the poster child. You know, he has a PowerPoint presentation that is just really shows off his business and all the things that he does. And you know, you think about R&D credit, and you think about the types of things that he's talking about in his PowerPoint. So, but we also are trying to think about the other types of things that might interact with this. So, you know, the gentleman from the Black Line Group talked about some types of entities that would be just one or two people. And we do find this is very difficult, even for large, complex organizations to file. So, you know, especially the smaller ones, there might be other tax credits that might be better suited or might find it difficult. What we don't want to do is create a mechanism for people that have that don't necessarily know what they're applying for, and then the Department of Revenue comes back and says, gosh, you don't apply here, you need to pay something back. One thing that, and this does, you know, we're not talking about the Black Line Group here, but one of the things that we've noticed in other parts is that sometimes folks go and talk to consulting services, and they say, you know, we can get you X amount in R&D credit, and but then you need to pay us 10 or 20% of that credit. Now, then they go and apply, and they pay the consultant for the services in order to get the large credit, and then maybe most of the credit is disallowed, and then the taxpayer comes to us and says, I got this consulting, I got to pay for 10% of my credit, and now, you know, you disallowed 95% of my credit for expenses that weren't eligible. And we don't want to put taxpayers in those situations either. One other comment, Senator Gazelka, I know you talked about some of the larger businesses. I think one of the largest things that help some of our largest businesses is something that has been phased in over time, which is single sales apportionment. You know, Medtronic, the type of sort of tax liability is just about sales in Minnesota rather than sales everywhere, right? So that's, I think, when we talk about all of the things going on with Medtronic, it's really a federal tax discussion in terms of what they're talking about in Minnesota. But I'm not trying to discount the testimony that the type of refundability or other types of things that are offered in some of the bills today would be a benefit to them. I'm not trying to discount that testimony, but single sales apportionment is sort of the big thing here. The R&D credit can be difficult for many to calculate. In our experience with the department, we find many credits require adjustment because taxpayers have difficulty in accurately calculating the credit. So we do have concerns with fraud, with especially in terms of the refundable individual income tax credits. So that's something that we're sort of trying to think through here. If this were to move forward, we'd like to discuss with you approaches to limit the potential for fraudulent returns. The use of the R&D credit in Minnesota statute limits the credit to the amount of tax imposed on the entity creating the credit. So this reflects an IRS provision to limit the credit to the tax applicable to the income of the trade or business. So this Minnesota limitation was written when only corporations were allowed the R&D credit, and we would like to discuss this interaction if this were to be moved forward. Right now there's a potential to say that the credit could be applied against income not generated by the entity. It could be generated by a spouse or could be a side business or a side income that you might have. Madam Chair, Senator Rest, I know that your bill also has talks about the that this would have to go through a certification from deed. So that's something that we're looking at to say what might be a role in terms of that deed would play. You know, it would allow deed to look at the amount of the R&D credit. And we're just wondering what might be the actual role that might be the best to do. So we'd like to continue that discussion. If DOR is the agency that continues to be responsible to verify the R&D expenses, the deed certification would add an extra step. It also might limit our ability. And, you know, if they get certified from deed, they might think that they got the credit, but then they might come to the department and find out that it's a different amount. Right now, we're adjusting most R&D credits because it is so difficult to calculate. So, again, this is something that we're really interested in working with the senators on, with the committee on, with your staff, in order to try and make the best possible provision here if this was a priority of the Senate.
Madam Chair, just one comment.
Yes, Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Cummins, the comment related to federal or state. First, on the federal level, no doubt that many of those issues are what matters, but those are often for companies to compete nationally versus internationally, and is it better to be here? And one of the questions we frankly should ask ourselves is why do they even want to go other places? But I think that state issues are very, very important for us to pay attention to our businesses in Minnesota, because we're not just competing internationally, we're competing with other states. And I want Minnesota to be the state that wins. I want not just now, but into the foreseeable future. And so that's why I try to pay attention to what some of the successful businesses in Minnesota that are great community members of Minnesota have to say, because they want to be here. But like Senator Thompson said, there's a number of other things that cause the decisions they make to be made. And so that's why I try to pay attention and look at state issues, because that's my responsibility.
Thank you. Senator Eaton.
Thank you. Mr. Cummings, I have a question. I was wondering if you could explain to me the single sales apportionment or clarify that. I don't want to make assumptions over what that means.
Well, the Madam Chair, members of the committee, and I might defer to staff, but in terms of the corporate tax, at one time there was a three-factor apportionment. So there was factors for property, there was factors for wages, and there were factors for sales. So, and over time, those factors were weighted differently. I know back in the early part of the last century, it was three factors, and they were weighted equally. I think for manufacturers, that changed, you know, to be more sales-based. And then there was a different selection for how those would be weighted. In the early aughts, it was a phase-in began to move towards single sales. Because if part of the factors is wages or part of the factor is property, what your the argument for single sales was to say that you're actually disadvantaging Minnesota-based companies, because if there's more wages in this state or if there's more property in this state, they're going to have to pay a higher share of the corporate tax than other people that might have jobs or properties in other states but are then using our economy. So the argument was then made that really we should have it based on the one factor of sales for people that are coming in and using our economy. So folks like Medtronic, who then are using the economies of every 50 states, they would just be talking about the sales into Minnesota rather than talking about the factors of their wages that they have in Minnesota or the properties in Minnesota. But I'd have to say that if I go any deeper, I may have to phone a friend.
thank you. That's just as much as I would understand anyway.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cummins. Any other questions for Department of Revenue members? Any other comments, Mr. Cummins?
Madam Chair, I do have other comments on the vendor allowance, but I do need to leave to go back to the House. I'm sort of in a yo-yo position today. So I'm wondering if the Chair would allow me to email those comments to members. And,
yes, we'd appreciate
they are,
that.
They're mostly administrative, just things that we're trying to figure out.
Thank you. And then
Madam
we'll,
Chair?
Yes.
Mr. Cummings, just make sure that you send those comments to the chief authors of the bills as well, who are not members of the committee, Senator Housley, if you would.
And I did talk to Senator Housley yesterday. And in fact, she was married in the church that I go to right now. So
found
some.
And we will also make sure that that gets entered. Your comments get entered in the minutes, I'm assuming, for the public.
No, I don't think we can do that since it's an email.
Yep.
Maybe we can do it later, but not today.
Yeah, not today. Okay, thank you, members. Right now, we need to, any other discussion on this bill? Then we need to lay over Senate File 305. All in favor of laying over Senate File 305, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Next, we will hear. All righty. We'll hand it back.
Senator Gazelka, thank you very much for appearing on behalf of Senator Coonan. And Senator Housley, I invite you to come forward as well. And as she is doing that, Senator Housley, what we have been doing is when we have bills that deal with the same subject, we bring the authors up together, we discuss the differences between their bills, and then we go to the testimony. Before we do that, we do have a quorum, and we have the minutes before us. Senator Dietzick moves adoption of the minutes from the hearing of the Tax Reform Division of Wednesday, January 28th. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails and the minutes are adopted. So we have two bills before us today that deal with vendor allowances, and then Senator
Senator Housley's bill adds another feature with regard to the rules under which you have to file a tax return to start with, raising that from I think it is $500 to $1,000 to change the reporting period. But we'll let you both explain your bills, and Senator Gazelka will start with you on behalf of Senator Coonan.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Coonan, I think he said he had either seven or nine bills to present
in
the, today.
I'm in Education Committee.
A workhorse.
So
but
We'll remember that.
Yeah, that's right. Senate File 324 allows retailers to deduct and retain an allowance of 1% of the retailer's sales and use tax liability for their remittance period. A $5 minimum is required. According to a 2006 report by PricewaterhouseCoopers, it costs the average retailer 3.9% of the tax they collect to administer sales and local taxes. Businesses in Minnesota currently pay 100% of the costs associated with collecting and remitting state sales taxes, which includes employee training, point-of-sale system programming, accounting, remitting, and auditing. 28 states currently allow retailers a vendor allowance for collecting and remitting sales and use tax. Most of the states bordering Minnesota reimburse retailers for collecting and remitting sales and use tax. And finally, Senate File 324 invests in Main Street, Minnesota. Brick-and-mortar businesses continue to be impacted by higher costs, burdensome mandates, and increased regulations that create competitive disadvantage with border communities and online retailers. A sales tax vendor collection allowance will help offset some of the cost incurred by Minnesota retailers for collecting and remitting sales tax on behalf of the state. And there are two or three or four testifiers, but
we'll wait to hear from them after we hear from Senator Housley. Senator Housley, welcome to the division. If you would like to explain your bill, we'd be happy to hear from you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 160 is similar to Senator Coonan's. It does change the threshold requirements for filing from 500 up to 1,000. It also requires the Department of Revenue to develop an address-based sales tax calculator, and it provides for a vendor allowance.
Actually, there's a whole lot more to it than that, but that's just fine. We'll take the testimony and we'll fill in the bare bones from there. First of all, we understand this is a high priority for the Minnesota retailers, and we would invite Mr. Neustadt to come forward to speak to us, and would ask Senator Housley if you just stay there if you like. That'd be great. Mr. Neustadt, you please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Bruce Neustadt. I represent the members of the Minnesota Retailers Association. We're a collection of about 1,000 retail store locations across the state of Minnesota, and we're here to support Senate File 324, Senator Coonan's bill relating to vendor collection allowance. It's not a concept that is foreign to the committee here, and as Senator Gazelka mentioned, 28 other states currently have a vendor collection allowance, and there are a few contextual reasons for why that might be important to look at here in Minnesota right now. One of those is it's become a little bit of a tough environment for retailers within the past three, four, 5 years. If you think about your average Main Street retail in any of your communities, you can probably acknowledge that they've experienced some cost pressures, some competition pressures, some mandate pressures, some business expense pressures as well. So we think this is a bill that's time has come relative to thinking about it in terms of relief for some Main Street retailers that have been taxed over the past few years, but also an opportunity for other retailers to reinvest in their communities. So it's both a relief and an investment opportunity for us here at the state. Senator Gazelka said it quite nicely. Actually, there are some very hard costs that are involved in collecting and remitting sales taxes here in the state of Minnesota. It includes employee training, accounting for those funds, The occasional sales tax audit, filing in a timely manner, oftentimes invoking an outside resource such as an accountant to handle these procedures for you. So you have some very hard costs that exist within the system here in Minnesota. In addition to that, you have some costs relating to, as an example, processing credit cards, the swipe card fees on the sales tax portion of a swipe also gets charged back to the retailer. So at the end of the day, most of your retailers actually have less money to remit than they have actually collected. And that is why these 28 other states look at providing some type of relief for retailers. As Senator Gazelka mentioned, the average is just a little over 3% according to that 2006 study. It's worth mentioning that that was a study done by both private sector and public sector entities. The range of costs for a small retailer, as an example, in that study said it just costs over 12% actually to administer the sales tax system. A large retailer just under 3%. So the range is somewhat diverse depending on the size of retail. From that perspective, though, I think it's important to note that vendor collection allowance at 1% then is in no way intended to be a big windfall for retailers or for Minnesota businesses. It's really meant to just help cover a portion of those costs that they incur relative to the sales tax collection system. Also important to note as well, I speak to it relative to retailers, anyone who submits state sales tax would be eligible for this. So as an example, as a nonprofit organization, we sell some employment posters, we charge sales tax on those. So other organizations would be impacted by this as well. So we would ask that you consider joining the 28 other states that have made this a priority relative to providing relief and community investment for Minnesota retailers, including our neighbors closely to us, Wisconsin, North Dakota, and South Dakota, and appreciate your thinking of this bill and considering it. We know that there is a financial cost to this bill, the 1% bill, which is Senator Coonan's bill. It's a very simple bill, which we appreciate. We also know that over a two-year cycle of $10.1 billion in sales tax that entities will remit to the state, that can be a costly bill. So we would certainly entertain discussing the levels, including things such as caps and floors, as this goes forward. So with that, Madam Chair, if you indulge me, I do have two retailers with me today that would like to provide some brief testimony for the committee. I'd like to invite Bonnie McWhorter and Kendall Crosby.
Mr. McWhorter, welcome to the committee, and we'd be pleased to have your testimony, and we'd ask you that you identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lonnie McWhorter. I'm the owner and operator of Lawn Vixen Service Center. It's located in South Minneapolis. I've been involved in that business since June 9th of 2005, so just about 10 years. As a small retailer, to give you a perspective, the store is only 806 square feet usable for retail, and we have about 8 employees. 4 of those are full-time. The other 4 are part-time by choice. What this bill would mean for our store and the way that we operate, it would directly go toward helping better the perception of the store, helping us differentiate ourselves, and also directly to the many people who make the success of the store possible, mainly our staff. Over the past 9 years, it's been a challenge to learn the retailing business, and you know, we would not have made it this long without that help of the many employees and also outside vendors who have also contributed toward helping us be a success. And I believe that this bill would directly help us in terms of simplifying the really get putting more resources back in our control, where we can allow to refocus our energies on building a better business as well in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. McWhorter. Any questions for Mr. McWhorter? Then we'll move on to Mr. Crosby.
Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, if you'd identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. I appreciate that. My name is Kendall Crosby. I am the CFO for Kendall's Ace Hardware. We own 2 retail hardware stores in St. Paul, one in the Payne and Failand area, one on the Frogtown neighborhood. And our business, we started in 1992, and we've grown considerably in the last few years. We just opened up a new store on the Payne and Failon. We're directly involved with revitalizing 2 of the poor neighborhoods in St. Paul. part of revitalizing that is raising our sales. And what we have noticed, or what I have noticed since 1992, is the percentage of credit card sales. In the olden days, maybe 10% of the people would use credit cards in our sales. We ran $2.1 million in net sales in 2014, and 49% of that was used with credit card sales. So the people are using a different form than just cash and checks. They're using a large portion of it to be credit cards, which has a good fee attached to it to take these credit cards. I don't encourage the credit cards. It's the companies that are encouraging it, and we're kind of losing against that battle. But anyways, the half of our sales go down as credit card sales, and that portion is also charged on a sales tax. We have a CPA that does all of our accounting just to do our sales tax, and we found out in 2008 one of our electronic filings was not filed on time. It did not go through the system, was hung up. And about 2.5 to 3 months later, we found out that the sales tax was not paid. We immediately paid it after we went through our accounting system. 4 years later, we went through a sales tax use audit, mm-hmm. which is normal, and just to get me on the right track to pay what I'm supposed to pay in taxes, which we really appreciated. What we didn't like was the extra 10% fine that we got for a late sales tax. We'd never been late since 1992, only one time, but they do hang on to that, and they assessed a 10% fee on top of that. It does have a cost to take these sales. And what I noticed was is there's a partnership between two people, the state and the retailers, and there is a cost involved to process the sales tax on both sides. We do not have a way to collect that cost at all. The state does have a portion to handle covering their clerical fees, which is what they should, but the retailers never set up a fee. And I think that's a glitch in the system from day one. I think it's there is a cost involved to process everything, and the state recognizes it by charging a small percentage or whatever it is to collect for their clerical fees, but the retailers on the other side have nothing involved in. So I'm very much for a vendor collection allowance. Never thought of it before until I started looking into my numbers a little closer. So I would that's what I'm here to say. There is a definite cost involved for collecting sales tax. So that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Crosby. Are there comments or questions? Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you both for testifying. I'm trying to get a handle on in my head because I have no clue. I don't have a small business, so I have no clue how much a business that would pay sales tax receipts averaging less than $500 a month, what that looks like, and what one that is more than $500 a month, and then what would be one that is $1,000 a month. So can you give me a clue? I mean, I don't want to delve into your, proprietary info, but I'm
Senator Dietzick, now you're speaking to the provision about the filing thresholds rather
Correct.
Than the vendor allowance itself. I don't know whether the two testifiers want to speak to that, which is only in Senator Housley's bill, and maybe she can answer that. We'll direct that question to her. What's the impact of the going from 500 to 1,000, and what about those who go above that in any quarter? How is the clawback accomplished with that?
Thank you, Madam Chair. It would be a business for the $1,000 to bump it up would be $175,000 per year in taxable sales, and the average would be the authorization would remain in effect as long as the retailer's last four quarterly returns do not average more than $3,000 per quarter. So that's kind of the parameters for that, $175,000 in taxable sales.
Is that helpful, Senator Dietzick?
We're getting there.
We're getting there, okay. any other comments or questions for the testifiers?
Did you want to answer that?
We next have
Jamie Fuel, from the, and we'll excuse the first two testifiers, from the Minnesota Grocers. Welcome to the committee, Ms. Fuel, if you'll identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Members of the committee, good morning. I'm Jamie Poole, President of the Minnesota Grocers Association, and I, too, am here to speak in support of Senate File 324. Just for some background, the Minnesota Grocers Association is a state trade association. We represent the food industry since 1897. We have over 200 retail members that service nearly 1,100 stores statewide. We also have over 100 distribution and manufacturer members. Our member companies employ over 125,000 union and non-union Minnesotans, and the food industry is the backbone of every community, providing one out of 20 jobs in our state. Minnesota is very unique in that we still have a culture of the small, independent, locally owned grocery and convenience store. They create jobs, support their charities, and provide a safe and responsible shopping experience. I'm going to give you just a little bit of background about the shopping experience. An average sale per customer transaction in your local grocery store is about $31, with an average customer stopping in our store 1.6 times a week. The average family of four has a weekly shopping basket of $128. The retail food industry typically operates on a net profit margin of around 1%. Currently, our members pay all costs surrounding the collection of sales tax. We remit it to the Department of Revenue. These costs include training, point-of-sale programming, equipment updates, accounting system setups, the execution of state audits, which if any of you have been through those, even if you follow the letter of the law, they are very, very cost in for our employees to get ready for those. And then there is a lot of man hours that go into that. As the State Trade Association, we produce this book annually for our members to help in the complication of administering sales tax, because it is very complicated for us at checkout. The bill before you, Senate File 324, as you've heard, allows for a sales and use tax vendor collection allowance. This will reimburse your local retailer about 1% of the total amount of sales and use tax remitted to the state. Your local grocery store would probably receive around $500 a year under this proposal. And at 1%, that compensation is significant to offset those costs. And this is not a new concept. As you've heard, 28 other states do allow this. One of the things that I think is also important that comes up is Minnesota is a streamlined sales tax state. And about 50% of those states that do have the vendor collection allowance are also streamlined sales tax. So this does not put that into jeopardy or challenge that format. In addition, in 2013, this legislature passed a language acknowledging the ongoing costs of business. There was a prepaid phone card that we sell. There's a E911 fee that we now have to collect at checkout, and 3% of that we are able to keep when we remit that to the state. So the Department of Revenue has an ongoing system and has acknowledged that there is a cost to retailers. So I think that that's important to know. The grocery store, I always like to say, is the heart of our community, and we are essential to allowing Main Street, Minnesota to flourish. Economic growth is critical. Brick-and-mortar businesses, as you've heard, continue to be impacted by high costs, mandates, and increased regulation. This legislation supports growth on Main Street, Minnesota, by providing a reinvestment in the grocers and convenience stores. We thank Senator Gazelka for stepping in this morning, Senator Coonan, and we also thank Senator Housley for their work. I'm happy to stand for any additional questions.
Thank you. You mentioned that Minnesota is a streamlined sales tax state, and as a matter of fact, was one of the original ones.
Yes.
And I serve on that, the governing board, as you probably also know, of streamlined sales tax. We are currently becoming less and less hopeful that the federal government is going to pass marketplace fairness, which would require remote sellers to remit the sales taxes that are owed in the states of the buyer, and it's one of the provisions in the past of the Marketplace Fairness Act has been the setting up of the certified service providers, which in a sense is a service that the businesses individually now in Minnesota are doing for the state and collect for in-state sales. The federal bill, the current federal bill, as I understand it, however, has no such requirement for the CSPs, although I think it's a good idea and I think we should continue to hope that that is a, quite frankly, a requirement of the federal legislation. What I'm very concerned that Congressman Goodlatte is going to come in with a bill that has origin sourcing, which would be disastrous for all consumers, period, but particularly in Minnesota, where even though I might feel that we should broaden the base and lower the rate, we do not tax clothing. And the notion that a Minnesota consumer would have to pay a 10% Illinois tax for an item that they don't purchase in Illinois, but they purchase it here, is something that I don't believe any federal representative is going to vote for. That being said, certainly the experiences of the other states that have allowed a vendor allowance under the current law, which is what you're proposing to be changed. It does carry a big price tag for which is how we look at tax relief is a cost, and that's how we have to deal with it in the tax committee. The proposal, obviously, just like the R&D credit ones, Senator Gazelka and Senator Housley, is also scalable once again. You might say even at 1% that the costs of particularly of smaller businesses, I don't have any particular feeling for huge businesses, but the smaller businesses may be more than 1% of the sales, but it's a number, and it is scalable. And what I think is more important is a discussion of the policy of allowing it, rather than whether it should be 1%, 0.5%, 0.25%, 2%, or whatever. And I wonder if you could speak just a little bit more, either you or Mr. Neustadt, about the experience in the states that have a vendor allowance of how satisfied they are with the costs that are borne by the taxpayers to allow the vendor allowance. At a macro level, I'm sympathetic to it, because I believe that, as I think one of you pointed out, there is a partnership here in remitting the taxes, and then between the state and vendors, and we too often don't acknowledge that. So you want to talk about either one of you about the experience of other states, and certainly Senator Gazelka and Senator Housley, please join in. Ms. Fuel.
Yep, thank you, Madam Chairman. You know, Chairman, I know that from my counterparts in other states, there certainly doesn't seem to be a pushback. I do, in being very honest, I do know that Illinois, through the course of their budget conversations, goes back and forth, and they have determined that it is a value and they continue to keep it, though it's always on the table for discussion there. Sure. But I think In to your point, we certainly agree from where we sit. We appreciate this committee and the author's willingness to have the conversation. Where we end up and if there is an opportunity to negotiate that through, I think is a little bit of the sidebar, but that there is an acknowledgement, and that Minnesota now has acknowledged that we do have a cost to do this, and I think that's the relevancy. There's a wide span, if you look at the 28 other states, of how they do it, whether it's a cap, whether it's influx in percentage, but again, I haven't heard pushback or you know, and again, I participate on the streamlined sales tax in a listening mode, and I haven't heard a lot of conversation to that. Like I say, Illinois is one that I do know continually, and they've got had a lot of complications in that state, so it's something that, but they continue to hold on to that. So,
Mr. Neustadt.
Madam Chair, before I get into it, I do want to thank this committee for its work on e-fairness and affiliate nexus over the last couple of years. And we're frustrated by federal movement on that as well, but we'll continue to work on it. I have maybe a little bit more optimism than you do, Madam Chair, but we'll keep working on it. That's the next piece. But thanks to Minnesota for showing its momentum and adding its leadership in that conversation. On the policy side of vendor collection allowance with these 28 other states, although you do hear a discussion about what the right amount is, and you know, some states have some very complicated. Virginia, as an example, has a tiered type approach that's somewhat complicated. Throughout the ones that do have vendor collection, though, from a policy perspective, I think we do find that there is an appreciation on behalf of the business community and retailers in the state acknowledging those expenses. Now, some of those models may not be perfect relative to reimbursing much or in some cases any of those costs, and some are more generous relative to how they look at that reimbursement. From a policy perspective, I think you do create an atmosphere where there's an appreciation for retailers when you acknowledge the fact that there is this expense that they have. So, again, taking out the caps and floors and percentages, I think from a policy perspective, we would enjoy to continue to have that discussion because we think it's worthwhile.
Okay. Mr. Carnival, did you want to speak to the vendor allowance, and then we have Mr. Gilbertson who wants to comment, particularly about the Housley bill. Mr.
National
Carnival.
Waste and Recycling Association. I hadn't planned to testify this morning, but as I thought about this bill, it hit me that one of my clients, the waste hauling industry, would be affected by the policy here that we're talking about.
We would be very careful that they would not be affected by it. They would... That is one of the concerns of the Department of Revenue, that this is not, it would not apply to the waste haulers or who is, what was the other group that was mentioned that they, the revenue estimate does not apply to waste haul, would not apply to waste haulers or
car rental.
What is it?
Car rental.
Or car rental.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I
you're
guess
not in this bill, well, Mr. Carnival. I'm just letting you know.
That's exactly why I'm here, Madam Chair.
Yeah.
And the reason is that, as you recall, waste haulers are often dealt with very differently in statute. And they, although they are retailers in the sense that they provide services to people throughout the state at the for businesses as well as residential, they, in fact, did collect sales tax for many, many years until some years ago when, in an effort to streamline the taxing system, the legislature combined the sales tax and the solid waste fees that the waste haulers were collecting into a solid waste tax. So the solid waste tax is a combination of the sales tax and solid waste fees that the waste haulers are collecting. They have the same administrative costs, the same overhead, the same responsibilities as retailers, but simply don't put all of the money into the sales tax fund, but do it in a combination with the other fee that they collect that's now a different tax. But they do collect sales tax monies in the same way. So I would hope that if we're talking about the policy of people who are doing business with at retail, would consider this opportunity for these retailers to have the same allowance that other retailers have. I haven't had a chance to talk to the author nor to the proponents of the bill since it just hit me this morning that they might not be covered even though they provide the similar services.
And it's not, I'm just clarifying, you're not in the bill. Okay.
Right. Madam Chair.
Senator Dietzick.
I do have a question, though, for Mr. Carnival. So in the city of Minneapolis, you have municipal haulers and you have others. Do both the municipal haulers and the others, do they both collect sales tax and the solid waste management fee?
Madam Chair, Senator Dietzick, they both collect what is called the solid waste tax, which is a combination of the sales tax and the solid waste fee that are no longer sales tax
right.
revenues but are collected
okay.
in a different tax. That's why this doesn't apply, but conceptually should.
And, members, I would point out that my comment is not based on something in the revenue estimate, but just a sidebar conversation that apparently in some other states they follow the same kind of administrative setup for their solid waste taxes as they do for their just general sales and use tax.
and the department would be concerned that we understand that the revenue estimate does not include those, just or the rental cars.
Madam Chair, I totally understand that the
statutorily a different tax.
I understand the revenue estimate doesn't include this, but conceptually, we think it should. The exemption should.
Note your comment.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Gilbertson, welcome to the committee. We're pleased to have you here. If you'd identify yourself for the record, please give us your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Gilbertson. I'm from Magic Balance, Inc. It's a party rental business. We have inflatables, bungee trampolines, climbing walls, and such that we bring to private events, public schools, churches, and we also set up fun areas at festivals and so on. Where we charge per person. I contacted Bob Detmer and basically told him, I don't want to be a slave. There's a lot of work involved in collecting the sales tax, and we don't get reimbursed for any of it. I just gave testimony a few weeks ago. They had an article in the Session Daily, and in the article, the author on there, she wrote that where I'm based, which is Lionel Lakes, the sales tax is 6.85%. Don't know where she got that number, but if it's that complicated that somebody from the Capitol has an error on that, you can certainly imagine how difficult it is for us. She also said that I don't mind collecting the sales tax, and that was also a wrong point. I certainly do. There's a lot of headache that goes into it. Our company has about 100 W-2 employees. During the off-season right now, it's myself and my parents that operate. During the summertime, we deal with a lot of millennials, so you can imagine how difficult that is. And that's the time of the year where most of our sales are taxable. This time of the year, it's churches and schools. And I don't have to worry about that so much. Back in the day, it was easy. A customer called me. If a moonwalk was $160, I could tell them exactly how much it was after tax because it was just the state sales tax. Now, if somebody calls me up and they want to put through an order and they say, hey, what's my total after tax? I have to say, I don't know, because I got to go to the USPS website first to put in their address so I can get the zip code plus four. I then have to go to the sales tax calculator website where I have to, that it requires the zip code plus four. And then it tells me what the total is. It'll tell me what the state tax is, the transit tax, the county, the city, and then If I'm going to go do an event myself out in Minneapolis, I got to put in that 3% Minneapolis tax. So when I'm creating my invoices, I got to do that. And my software doesn't have a breakdown for all these separate taxes. It just has the final line. So in my own area, my tax would be 7.125. That would be the state sales tax and the transit. And then later in the month, when it comes time to file, I got to go through all these different invoices, and I got to say, okay, how much do I owe to the state? How much do I owe to Hennepin County? How much do I owe to transit? How much do I owe to Minneapolis? And it's an absolute headache. This is not something I can hire a minimum wage employee to do, which, considering minimum wage is going up, even that would be pretty costly here. My taxes or the sales tax I charge is based on where I deliver to rather than where I'm delivering from. So it costs me more, or costs the customer more in Minneapolis than it would in my own neighborhood in Lana Lakes. Bruce was saying earlier from the Minnesota Retailers Association. Oh, I just lost my train of thought here. I apologize.
It's okay. Take your time.
They do this for a living. I don't, so I'm also the janitor at Magic Bones. Where was I here? Okay, so I'm charging based on my destination rather than my origin. And for me, it would make it a lot easier if I could charge from my origin. I had posted something on Facebook, and I got friends all around the country that are in the same industry. And one of the guys says, hey, we don't have to deal with that. We just charge the sales tax based on where we're located from. And I think one of my competitors might be a little confused too, because I look at their frequently asked questions on their website, and one of them was about sales tax, and they say we charge everybody 7.125%. I wish I could follow the same rules or whoever told them that misinformation. You know, if I'm a large grocery store chain, I can maybe afford to deal with all these little things that it takes to collect the sales tax. It might be a very small percentage of my sales, but being a real small business like myself, I got to do the same amount of work to get everything in place. Right now I use the industry software that doesn't calculate all the taxes on the different levels. I may decide to switch over to something else that can handle that, but I got to figure out how to import my current customer list, my previous invoices and all that, and that would cost me money. My understanding is there's a system out there called TaxCloud, and apparently this is a service that does break all that the taxes down. And my understanding is that the state reimburses TaxCloud for that service. Yet if I were to do that service myself, right now I'm not getting any reimbursement. A few years ago, I was about ready to hop in my truck. I had it full of inflatables. I had a crew all ready to go. We were going to go to the Dakota County Fair, and we were going to set up a bunch of inflatables. This was in August, and I just got a phone call from the Department of Revenue, and they said, hey, we're coming out. We're going to do a sales tax audit. And like I said, I work with a lot of millennials, I'm very seasonal, so I'm overwhelmed. I'm completely overwhelmed. And I told the lady, you're going to leave me alone. This is the second sales tax audit you guys have called me about. And based on the previous one, you would know that August is my busiest month of the year. I said, you're going to leave me alone. You're going to call me back when it's slower. Just like you wouldn't call up a snowplower and say, hey, there's 2 feet of snow. Come on in for an audit right now. Very untimely. You know, we're doing all this work for the state. You know, we're getting no compensation for it. We're not on the payroll for the state, and that's why I originally called Bob Detmer and said, hey, I don't want to be a slave. So I told the auditor, I said, hey, I'm trying to do everything I can not to kill myself. Leave me alone. Call me back in November. So I drive down the road in my box truck on the way to Dakota County Fair, and I get pulled over by the Lionel Lakes Police Department, and they say, hey, we can't make a professional determination if you're okay right now. We're going to send you to the hospital where they can make a professional determination. So the doctor did that. He made his professional determination. 30 minutes later, I was up on the sidewalk, had to get a ride back to my box truck so I could go to the Dakota County Fair. And a month or two later, I get a bill for the ambulance ride, which I got to pay, even though Lana Lakes couldn't make the professional determination. This is an absolute headache having to deal with all the sales tax stuff. This 3% vendor collection allowance just barely scratches the surface. It costs me a lot more than that. All my calls that I take orders for or from, since I'm doing it over the phone, when I process a credit card, it costs me more than what a grocery store would if they had to swipe a card, since they've got the card in hand. If I accept a card from somebody that's got perks, like a corporate perks card, I don't even know what the percentage is. I've been told that it costs me more to process that than it would some other cards. So that 3% might not even cover just the credit card processing fees that are involved with collecting that sales tax. I would ask that party rentals not be taxable. And I don't think that's a totally unreasonable request. Right here, I found a taxable item. This is a non-taxable item. So we got fruit roll-ups. These are taxable. These are Twizzlers. These are not. Plate. This is taxable. Frappuccino. This is not. I wish I had a $12.5 million Heidi Klum bra. If I did, that would not be taxable. So that would go over here. My Kit Kats, these are non-taxable. I can't keep track. In fact, I was trying to do a receipt this morning when I was at Cub Foods to make a pile of taxable and non-taxable, and I messed it up even after reading all the fact sheets last night. So as a company, we're provided all this information. Hey, go to the sales tax website, and there's a whole list of all these different fact sheets on what is taxable, what's not. In fact, when I get home, I get to look at the advertising, because if I print my own flyers and throw them in people's newspaper boxes, my understanding is I get taxed on that. If I go pay Red Plum to do it for me, if I recall correctly, I don't have to pay tax on that. So perhaps my inflatables could could somehow have a loophole like that too. I think I've got more in here. Snickers are taxable. Those Kit Kats weren't. Yogurt covered raisins, these are taxable. So somehow this is a candy, but this is not. I'm totally messed up.
Mr. Gilbertson, we in the streamlined sales tax conversations, we spent years finally determining what was not what was going to be taxable as such, because states are able to decide whether they're going to tax what they consider to be a food item as opposed to what they consider to be a candy item. And some states tax food and candy, and some stacks, some don't tax either, and some tax candy but not food. And the issue was one of definition, and that's why a lot of products that may look similar or at least give the same kind of similar experience are either taxed or not taxed depending upon whether they're food or candy. And the governing board spent more than one session talking about the food content, the flour content of candy versus food. So it is not an issue that was decided arbitrarily as such, and it is just a matter of definition rather than of tax policy itself. And obviously you've covered a broad field of tax issues here with us this morning, and we appreciate that, although these bills don't only deal with a vendor allowance and the filing, but we appreciate the difficulties and the complexities that are faced by business owners as they decide or find out how it is they need to go about fulfilling their obligations to the state. So we're happy you're here with us this morning. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Rice. This 3% starts to scratch the surface, but I don't think it even comes close to what's really involved. On the county and the city levels, we put a lot more effort into collecting the sales tax than what we actually have to remit. And it's a headache. I got my own business I'm trying to operate on top of the state's business here.
I understand that.
But I would certainly love if my product could be non-taxable.
Not going to happen.
Well, if I can go buy a Darth Vader costume and that can be non-taxable.
I'm joking, but probably not going to happen.
Darth Vader costume is non-taxable, but if I buy just the mask by itself, then I'm taxed.
We do appreciate you being with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments on this subject? Senator Gazelka, Senator Housley, any final comment?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We can see it's an issue, and I feel for Brian in that every time somebody calls that it's – and I looked it up last night, too, seeing all of the different taxes and what he has to go through and how much time it must take and who he has to pay to do this work when he just wants to deliver the bouncy inflatables for the kids to play on. So I hope somewhere there's a happy medium that we can at least do something to try and remedy this. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Housley. We may come back later to the issue of the difficulty of your proposal of moving to a 5-digit zip code away from the 9-digit zip code in finding out what the actual tax rate is. As I think you're well aware, the 5-digit zip code is very limited because it can go across jurisdictions, and that's why the nine digit code is used, because it does identify by specific community. But that's something we can continue to have conversations with the department about. Okay. Any further business before the committee? Mr. Gilbertson?
If I could make another quick addition, if I could input an address into the sales tax calculator, that would be a heck of a lot easier than having to go to the USPS website first to do so.
I understand that, but we also want you to be accurate and not collect more or less sales tax based on a five-digit zip code rather than a nine-digit. So there is an issue.
I'm talking about the full address.
No, I understand that, yeah.
So if
Senator Housley?
I think what he's trying to say is if somehow it were like a widget that could combine them, the USPS and the tax, so it was just a one process.
I understand that. Yeah.
Thank you.
What? You need to lay them over.
Yeah, so we have the Senator Coonan's bill. Senator Dietzick moves that Senator Coonan's bill be laid over for further consideration. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. And Senator Dietzick also moves that Senate File 160, Senator Housley, be laid over for further consideration. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Stay tuned. What is next?
Stay tuned. We have not yet set our schedule for next week. Is there a meeting of the full committee?
They are, but I don't know.
We will be getting out a schedule for hearings for next week, both for the full committee and the division. Likely, at least, that the division will meet once. There being no further business before the division, we stand adjourned.